we get things underway by getting on the telephone line and welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
What's up, Mr. Kimball?
Well, doing what we do here and trying to maintain an even keel in difficult times. It's tough when you, in your case, when you create something to promote what you do and the monument that you love, and bureaucracy gets in your way.
That is true. Now, I don't love the monument, and I don't think anyone who actually goes up the monument does love it. I have my purpose for going up it, but I'm in it yesterday, and I've done 13 days in a row now, at least five straight climbs. It was really vernal here yesterday. It was balmy, and I did five climbs in 26 minutes. As I'm doing my climbs, I think, okay, this park ranger down at the bottom, this guy really likes me. I came in, and I barely break stride. I give a hey, and he says, oh, it's always a great pleasure to see you. I mean, nobody's ever that nice to me. This is great. Other days when he sees me, he brags about me to nearby people. He says, this guy right here, this is the man going up five times or six. I'm thinking, like, I just wanted to do two. Now I'm going to have to do at least five. So I'm in there, and I think it would be a good idea to say to this guy, because they have this little, display, a little plastic slot on the wall where they print out something for, like, some retired high school teacher who's going to come in and talk to you about Johnny Tremaine. And we didn't talk about it at the time because it was the holidays, but I did this Wall Street Journal op-ed on something I called the Week Game, which was an alternative to New Year's resolutions and how it helped me give up drinking, and each week is this new battle, and the monument featured prominently in it. In fact, there was a photograph of the monument right where me and this guy were standing. So I come down and I said to him, I, sir, have a promotional opportunity for you and for me. And so I go into this thing. What would you say if you have this author and he does this piece in this well-known venue and it helped him give up drinking and it's this inspirational story and people don't like going up the monument and they ask me questions anyway and we put it right over here. And he says, well, I don't know. First of all, we have other sites. One of them is a Harbor Island site and another is a Black History site. And I'm thinking, am I allowed to say, this isn't about the Harbor Islands and I'm white? Can we do that? Can we just do it right here? There's a photo of this. He says, well, at the very least, I admire you for what you do. It's like, dude, really? Because kids come in here, they whine, they don't want to go up. So you could see this thing, and then you could see the man of the match in action, and it's just a different slant on the monument. And it was like, are we even able ever to get out of our own way anymore?
No.
It seems like it's almost like with publishing. You have this great idea, and you get, like, not even counting the bigotry and the hatred and the discrimination, all of that. And it's like you walk into the locker room, and you look at your team, and you want to sling some passes down the field, and there's a guy over there who's drunk, and there's a guy over there who has, like, no limbs. He's like, I'll go deep. It's like, this is my crew? I'm supposed to hit you over the middle with my vision? It's not going to work. And the monument, it's like, dude, just print it out, stick it in the slot. But nope, he's like, you could contact someone on the website. I said, I think I'm good.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. But we've got bigger fish to fry in our discussion this afternoon as we celebrate the 80th birthday of some terrific films, the year 1940. And let's begin with, well, what a combination. Errol Flynn, director Michael Curtiz, and the Spanish Armada. How do you beat that trio?
They work together a lot, that director and actor combo. And it couldn't have been easy on Curtiz's blood pressure because Flynn was just, well, he was great at being an alcoholic, really. I mean, like, he had a real skill for it. And they tried to limit how much booze he could have on the set. And he's like, I will enjoy some oranges. Please give me oranges. They help me stay sober. And he paid someone to inject the oranges with alcohol. Like, that's when you know you might have kind of sort of an issue. And it's this very swashbuckling film. You're getting your sea spray and all of that, and you can practically smell the brine coming through the television, the big screen, whatever you're watching this on. But it's also this kind of allegory of World War II and the rise of Hitler, which you wouldn't necessarily expect in a picture like this, which is supposed to be all about you getting your swash on, right? You wouldn't think that it's going to go in that kind of multi-dimensional direction, but it's exactly what it does. And this was big. Flynn was just as sizable an action hero as you got at the time, because the year before, of course, you have The Adventures of Robin Hood, and that film was probably still might be the best adventure film that we've ever had, the best forest-based swashbuckler. But yeah, this was this completely different departure, and it put him on the high seas. And I know you're a big Curtis guy, so it was a pairing that you wouldn't really expect from someone who helmed Casablanca, but there it is.
Also from 1940, another swashbuckler in a different locale, Tyrone Power, and the woman who was made to appear in movies like this, Linda Darnell, in The Mark of Zorro.
Yes, and I love all things Zorro. I always have. And you have the director of this film you wouldn't really think is going to be doing this tale of the fox. But it makes a certain amount of sense. It's the same guy who directed the best version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So you have this whole idea of one person representing the double, because Zorro, he's this meek, oh no, please don't do anything to me, I don't want to get upset, very foppish sort of person by day, and then he morphs into the fox at night. And even just mentioning that, although it's not the same production company, of course, do you remember the Disney version?
Oh, yes.
And that theme song, and Out of the Night When the Full Moon is Bright comes the horseman known as Zorro. And it was so simple in terms of plot. Father calls in this guy. He's like, son, and I have this situation going on. I have this baddie. I don't know what to do. He's like this oligarch of the town. It's not working out the way we wanted to. And Don Diego thinks, oh, fear not. I have a cape, and I have a mask, and I have a black horse, and this will just go fantastically well. And I will also romance the baddie's daughter, not because I'm trying to get an advantage, but because I actually dig her. And it's going to work out great for all involved, including my future bride.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's move to one of the classic comedy teams of all time, Laurel and Hardy, in the last film they made at the Hal Roach Studios, Saps at Sea.
I think these guys are the best comedy duo by far in the history of the motion picture. I think in terms of comic artistry, it's this pairing and Buster Keaton, and I don't think it's relatively close in terms of at least this vintage era. And you might think, like, okay, it's just going to be people falling over banana peels, and it's not. It's actually pretty sophisticated and clever to modern audiences, maybe sometimes too sophisticated and too clever for modern audiences, which is depressing, because this was kind of fair for children and maybe simple-minded adults at the time. But it holds up as art, because you have this duo as the quintessential clowns. Shakespeare could watch a film like this, laugh his ass off, and think, right, I totally get that. They're not that far removed from my fool, except they're not so acerbically tongued. And in this particular short film, not an actual short film, but it's a feature that runs less than 60 minutes. Oliver, he works in a horn factory, and that's not a good place for him because he doesn't like loud noises, and he develops hornophobia, which sounds like something that it isn't. And so his good buddy Laurel, first of all, doctor says, like, you know what you need? You need to go to sleep. That's what's going to make everything right for you. So we have some nice continuity there in our discussion. And he's like, no, I don't like to sail. That sucks. I get seasick, I'm frightened of that. So Laurel says, okay, we'll just get a boat and we'll chain it to the piling in the harbor, and we'll sit there. And the name of the boat is the Prickly Heat. And so they're there, and some guy escapes from prison, and he cuts the rope, and they drift off to sea, and they're on board with this murderer, and they have to find a way out of this situation. And it's a kind of postmodernism. If anyone has seen a Laurel and Hardy film, it's what so much of the David Brin character, I'm supposed to write a book proposal on this, in the British version of The Office is based on. It's completely in that tradition of I'm going to turn and look at the camera, but doing it in a subtle way so it's not this ostentatious showing of look how clever we are, but it pulls you into the film. It pulls you even more into the film, it seems, when they're adrift on the ocean, and it is hilarious, even for the modern audience, whether it's the slapstick, the verbal dialogue, the repeated jokes, the puns. James Joyce, too, could have looked at these guys and thought, huh, this is funnier than anything I ever tried to pull off in my work in terms of the wordplay.
Back to the sea we go for another film from 1940. Well, you talk about a talented group of players based on the writings of Eugene O'Neill, directed by John Ford, cinematography by Greg Toland, and some of those great Ford supporting players working with John Wayne, like Ward Bond, Thomas Mitchell, the great Barry Fitzgerald. It, unbelievable film.
It is the Ford acting troupe, and the presence of Eugene O'Neill plays. Now, O'Neill was a fairly prolix writer. It could not oftentimes be work that was well suited for film. But what actually they're doing here, too, is they're jamming a bunch of O'Neill plays together. So it seems like a logistical nightmare. And you have John Wayne, and it's a year after Stagecoach, this big sort of like breakthrough. And it's these guys, you have the troupe of actors, but you have the troupe of seamen on this merchant marine type boat, and they're carousers. They like to drink, they like to have a good time, they like their women and their ale and all of that. And they find out that they're going to be transporting dynamite. And it's a bit like the film Wages of Fear, which was a French film, the same guy who did Diabolique. And in that film, guys are risking their lives to run, again, explosives and cars, except this is Wages of Fear on the sea. And they want to get the John Wayne character back home, and they think that there's a spy on board, and they club this guy, and they tie him up, and they read this, they crack open this locked box he has, and they think it's going to have, like, some detonating device. And it's just this gutting sequence where it's letters from his wife asking him to come home. He doesn't need to be ashamed that he's an alcoholic. They'll still love him. But he's staying at sea. And then you have the deep focus. This is what Orson Welles saw when he was getting the idea for how to shoot Citizen Kane,
right,
of Greg Toland. He's looking at this film. This is not a well-known John Ford picture, and no one ever thinks of John Ford in the sea. You think of him with Westerns, and you think of him sometimes getting a little bit too close because he hammed it up to the Blarney Stone. He wasn't, like, so awesome with the whole I Love Ireland type of stuff. But this is a departure. There's no other Ford film like this. There's no other film shot like this because it's that deep focus until along comes Orson Welles with Citizen Kane. So it was a very important film, and it's really one of the five or six best films in the Ford filmography.
And then finally, another great 1940 film starring Peter Lorre, some really inventive editing and camera work, Stranger on the Third Floor.
This is an important film because this is going to mark the very first film noir. And our man Orson Welles is going to kill off the genre 18 years later with Touch of Evil, because that really took film noir and a lot of other parts of cinema as far as it could go. But this is another film that doesn't run very long. It's a little bit more than an hour, and you have a fine cast, like you mentioned, Peter Lorre. And it's directed by a guy who would not direct many films. And this is his first film that he ever does. And this particular director was someone who worked with Eisenstein in Russia, and he's bringing over this sensibility of Boris Ingster, bringing over the sensibility of the montage, but he's transmuting the montage, the editing style of montage that you would get with Russian cinema, into these lattice lines of shadow and these gateways of contrasting light and dark. And it establishes the entire film noir visual vocabulary right away in one movie. And it's a gripping little plot, but it's almost incidental what's happening with the plot. This is, how many films can you point to and say, that started an entire medium, submedium, movement, whatever you wish to call it, of filmic art? And that's exactly what we get with this film. And you have, and again, we've talked about him before, but when he is in the movie, Elijah Cook, you probably want to see that film. And it's worth noting, too, while we're on the subject of cinematographers, that Nicholas Musaraka is the director of photography for this film. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because he's going to shoot things like Out of the Past in 1947, the Robert Mitchum, Jane Greer film that I think is the definitive noir. But a lot of the artistry of a film like this comes from, it's almost like a co-director deal. That's why later Wells would give that virtual co-credit with Greg Toland, which was unprecedented for the most part. I think John Ford does it too at the end of Citizen Kane. And so you could have done the same thing here with Nicholas Musaraka, who is one of the great unheralded visual geniuses in all of film.
You know, people talk about 1939 as many will say the greatest year for films of all time, but go 1 year later and you've got these five terrific movies we talked about. But that was also the year of Chaplin's The Great Dictator, The Philadelphia Story, All This in Heaven 2, Grapes of Wrath. 1940, I think, an underrated year in the history of cinema.
I'm always interested in these works of art that are not lesser works of art, that are nonetheless interstitial. They're in cracks for some reason, and they shouldn't be. And I don't really want to equate it to, because when you mentioned that, I was thinking of a team like the dynastic New York Islanders or the early dynasty of the Patriots. And you think of those teams, they're so star-laden. But at the same time, the reason they're so great is because their complementary players are practically stars themselves. The rosters are just so deep. And I think that's what you're getting in some of these meatier years of classic Hollywood, because I think there's a lot of luck involved. We're talking about these films. I don't think The Long Voyage Home, that's a better film than Philadelphia Story. It holds up better as a work of art, but Philadelphia Story, for whatever reason, it caught the right notices at the time, it was reissued at the right time, and it just became this thing that we never revisit. You just accept it, and that's what it is. And I would call out to people, I'd challenge people to say, the canon is often misleading, and it needs to be more fluid in all of the different forms of art than we often just, we make it into this kind of cement or this lead. And you look at films like this, go out and watch some of them. You find them online. You find them at bootleg sites online. You don't have to pay anything. You'd be like, oh, wow. Fleming, he didn't actually steer me off course, to make a nautical pun. I like this one.
You never steer us off course. You are the captain of our Tuesday ship, the master of our soul.
Aye, aye, sir.
Thank you, Colin. We'll do it again next Tuesday.
Okay, I'll see you.
Visit ColinFlemingLit.com. Follow Colin on Twitter as well.